The death of a young African-American boy in Jim Crow, Mississippi was the inspiration for a major youth movement.
Every young person involved in the Mississippi civil rights movement made reference to Emmett Till.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear what was done in the name of Emmett Till. We'll also hear how moving around the world affects students in military families and spend an academic minute with a good rivalry. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. When talking about the civil rights movement in the South, the name Emmett Till is bound to come up. His murder is widely remembered today as one of the most brutal lynchings ever in the U.S. But while Till's death terrorized young African Americans in Mississippi, it also gave them a rallying cry. That's the story Robert H. Mayer tells in his new book, In the Name of Emmett Till, How the Children of the Mississippi Freedom Struggle Showed Us Tomorrow. Dr. Robert Mayer is an educator and award-winning author who still teaches the occasional history course to middle school students in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. I asked why he chose Emmett Till as the starting point for these stories.
Well, when I began to do my research and reading and watching the interviews that were the foundation for the book, just about every person involved, every young person involved in the Mississippi civil rights movement made reference to Emmett Till as an event that inspired them, that moved them to get involved. And these are people who were probably around the age of Emmett Till or even younger. Then later on in their lives, when they're older, 18, 19, they become involved in the movement, and the factor that motivates them the most is the murder of Emmett Till.
Did your experience, you say you've done some teaching in middle school recently, did your experience with those students kind of help you decide whose stories to tell in this book or how to tell them?
Yes. I'm tutoring now. Many years ago, my first teaching was as a high school history teacher, so a lot of this goes back to them as well. But the ones I'm tutoring now, I'm tutoring some eighth graders, and it does give me a sense to talk to them. What is it in a text that resonates for them? What moves them? What kinds of issues are important to them? But then going back to my high school teaching, the book grows out of the challenge of teaching history to young people because history tends to be a subject that young people do not initially ignite with. And so I struggled through my years of teaching to figure out how do you engage young people in history. And then when I started writing, that question continued. So one of the things I discovered, or I guess came to, was that there are young people who are actually involved in history. I looked for that, and the best place to look for that and find it is in the civil rights movement.
How important is it to educate young people about these stories and kind of teach them that it's not really ancient history?
It isn't. And if I were teaching these things, if I were teaching, I taught ninth grade, I would start with the present and connect issues that we're talking about today back to the time of the civil rights movement, but we could move it back even further.
You are very open, and you right in the beginning of the book, you say you are going to use the N-word in this book, and you're not just going to put N and then a couple of stars after it. You spell it out. How did you come to that decision?
It's not easy. But the use of the N-word fits into just the ugly context of Jim Crow America. And one of the things that I don't want to do when I write is to, you know, smooth over things. I want the reality to be there. And the reality of the use of that word emphasizes the reality of Jim Crow. Now, I balance that with, and this occurred to me when I was teaching I teach a civil rights course at a college level right now. And some of my students, after we saw a film on the Freedom Rides, and we saw, you know, buses being firebombed, people willing to kill people on a bus because of their hatred. And students stayed afterwards, some African-American students stayed afterwards and talked to me about the pain of watching that. And then it occurs to me that a lot of the things we talk about in the course would cause pain. So in making the decision, I have to balance that this is looking at this word. It should cause pain to all of us, but it's going to cause pain in particular to African-American readers. But on the other hand, it's pretty clear that they also, my students, do not also want me to paint a rosy picture where it doesn't exist, tell the reality.
After a year, it really is jarring just to see it in print.
Yeah, and we should add that it appears always in a quote from somebody who, I guess we could say on the other side of the movement, expressing their views. So it's something, it comes through in quotes.
Well, just to get everybody familiar with where you started, tell us a bit about Emmett Till and his story.
Sure. And this is one of those stories that causes pain. Emmett Till in 1955 was a 14-year-old boy living in Chicago with his mother, and he begs her to allow him to travel down south to Mississippi, to the Delta, to spend time with his cousins. And she agrees to allow him to do that. He goes down, he spends time with his cousins, he's staying near Greenwood, Mississippi, and one day they take a trip over to a store, Bryant's Grocery, in nearby Money, Mississippi. They're sitting in front of the store, and Emmett decides he wants to go in and get some bubble gum. When he goes in, he encounters a woman, Carolyn Bryant. She's white. She is the wife of the owner, Roy Bryant. We don't know exactly what happened in the store. He might have put money directly in her hand and not put it on the counter. He might have left the store saying goodbye and without saying ma'am, and that would have violated both of those things would have violated the code of conduct for African Americans in Jim Crow, Mississippi. So he goes out, and she follows, and she's walking to her car. He lets out a wolf whistle, which is a major violation of that code of conduct. And his cousins know that. They grab him. They take him home. Hopefully, it'll pass over, but it doesn't. A couple of nights later, Roy Bryant, Carolyn Bryant's husband, shows up at the house where Emmett's staying. And he and J.W. Milam, his stepbrother, kidnap Emmett. They torture him. They brutally murder him. And they dump his body in the Tallahatchie River. The hero of this story is Emmett's mom, Mrs. Mamie Till Mobley. She has Emmett's body brought back to Chicago for an open casket funeral and allows a photographer from Jet Magazine to take a picture of Emmett's body. And that picture appears in Jet Magazine and other media for African-American audience. And the entire world now knows what has happened. And now that goes back to the original question. That's where all of these young people find out about Emmett Till. They see it in this medium, most of them making reference to the Jet Magazine picture.
Mm-hmm. Still to come, our conversation with Robert H. Mayer continues with the story of another major name in the Mississippi civil rights story, Medgar Evers. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest is Robert H. Mayer, an educator and award-winning author. We're talking about his new book for students called In the Name of Emmett Till, How the Children of the Mississippi Freedom Struggle Showed Us Tomorrow. Another major figure in the civil rights movement in Mississippi was Medgar Evers, who played a key role in securing the involvement of the NAACP in the effort to publicize and bring justice to the case of Emmett Till. I asked Dr. Mayer to talk about Medgar Evers.
Sure. And here I talk from my perspective as a history teacher. I did not teach about Medgar Evers when I was teaching, and I taught a lot of black history. He's somebody we don't teach, but we need to teach. He was associated with the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which before the young people, the SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, came in, the NAACP was the militant organization in Mississippi. He was one of those activists who went door to door, meeting everybody, getting everybody enthusiastic, going to meetings, talking to people. And in particular, he organized the youth councils of the NAACP and worked with these young people and inspired these young people. So we don't know him because he wasn't a flamboyant speaker. He worked, you know, individually. But again, he's somebody that I very much want people to know about.
And he, of course, was shot in front of his own house on the street. We hear about Medgar because of the retrial, which happened, what, just 20 years ago or so?
Right. I think so. I think that's right. The murderer was first, he was acquitted, but then many years later that he was found guilty and spent his last years in prison.
How radical or revolutionary was it to have civil rights speakers at the 1964 Democratic Convention?
It opened the eyes of people, especially white Americans. And mainly the person who did that the most was Fannie Lou Hamer, a woman who grew up as a sharecropper from the time she was six and got fired because she went to register to vote. And on her way back from a conference she attended in Winona, Mississippi, was severely beaten. And that story of the beating becomes very important because at the 1964 Democratic Convention, where people from Mississippi were trying to get their delegation, not the all-white delegation, but their delegation seated, she spoke and she told her story about being beaten. And it's probably for a lot of white Americans, it was the first time they would have heard that kind of story directly from somebody who experienced it. It was so troubling to the president, Lyndon Baines Johnson. He wanted to have a convention where everybody was positive, everybody's arms around each other convention. And Fannie Lou Hamer's story kind of made that difficult. So President Johnson, in the middle of her talk, this is being seen on television, he calls a press conference. So she has taken off, but people still see her. Even though they don't see it live, it's played on the news. So revolutionary is a good word to use in terms of the speaking at the convention.
How blind was Northern America to the situation in Southern America in those days?
Oh, I would have to ask it also as a question. I'm not sure. I think about it a lot in terms of Emmett Till, because one of the things that comes through so clearly is how much the African-American community knew about Emmett Till. I don't think the same was true of the white community. I'm not absolutely sure. I don't think the gaze of white Americans was very much on what was happening with Jim Crow in the South. But it's something I haven't studied, and it's something that I don't think is studied a lot, but needs to be studied. I think we need to know that. It seems to some extent it's possible that the same thing happens today. I'll listen to African-American students tell me about their experiences going into stores and being watched, or they'll tell me stories about driving down the street and getting stopped by the police. And I have to admit that up until a couple of years ago, I wasn't aware of that. So I'm projecting back and thinking that the same, and maybe much more so, was true of white America in the 50s, especially in the 50s. I think in the 60s, people started to become more aware.
Racism, Jim Crow, certainly wasn't, the South was kind of famous for it, but it certainly was a nationwide thing. Could someone write a book of similar stories from the Northeast or the Northwest?
Definitely. I know personally, I grew up in Cincinnati, and I know personally that the school system, not completely, but there had been a conscious segregation, that some schools were designated as all black, and just in the way that the districts were drawn. So I was aware of that. But yes, there could be a story told that captures that same sense. I know of it much more. I'm writing right now about the period before the Civil War. And before the Civil War, there was slavery in the South, but in North, it was what we think of as Jim Crow. I mean, it was complete segregation. And I know that that experience continued through in the 20th century. Well, we know Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote beautiful things about the redlining and how housing in the North was consciously segregated. So, yes, there can be much written about the same level of racism and discrimination in the North.
Many of these stories now are finally part of some curricula in schools. Given the current, and I'm going to call it hysteria over critical race theory, is that going to put a bit of a roadblock in telling these stories in schools?
Well, I hope not. I hope that this is something that will pass. It could be temporary, and it could mean that people need to stand up and fight. It seems like the battle for teaching black history within the context of American history, it seems like that battle's been won. And maybe I want to be hopeful about this, that people understand that we need to tell this story. If we don't tell black history, we don't talk about the civil rights movement, including the ugliness of racism, that we're not telling the story of American democracy, because those things are a contradiction to American democracy. So I'm hoping if, as you say, the hysteria, once that settles down, where there's a chance to talk about things, that hopefully people would come to accept the need and the importance of telling this story, or we're not telling the full story of America.
Well, finally, you mentioned that Emmett Till's mother was the hero of that story. Did you discover in your research and as you wrote this, a lot of other young heroes of this story?
Yes. The title is in the name of Emmett Till, but the subtitle, How the Children of the Mississippi Freedom Struggle Showed Us Tomorrow, the book is really about those young people in Mississippi, their response to the murder of Emmett Till, and it's a story of heroes, which is another reason why I think people should be excited to hear the story, black history and the civil rights movement. It's American heroes, and they're people whose names probably most wouldn't know. Brenda Travis, who led a walkout of her high school because she had been expelled for her civil rights activities. Sam Block, who was a young man, went into Greenwood, Mississippi, and created on his own a voter registration movement. I tell the story of the Ladner sisters, Joyce and Dory Ladner, who got started very early. They started NAACP youth councils when they were, I believe, like 12 and 13, and continued their civil rights activities as they got older, working with Medgar Evers. So the book is filled with those stories. And despite the fact that Emmett Till hovers over everything, the book is in many ways very positive. And I think there's a sense of uplift because you see these young people in the context of a very ugly environment standing up and doing really beautiful things. So yes, the book has many stories about these amazing young people.
Again, the name of Robert H. Mayer's new book is In the Name of Emmett Till, How the Children of the Mississippi Freedom Struggle Showed Us Tomorrow. It's published by New South Books. A new survey of more than 2,000 teenage military dependents shows that their mental health is suffering. The survey was initiated by two students who also created a group that aims to address feelings of isolation and depression in military kids. For the American Homefront Project, Anne Kniggendorf reports.
Elena Ashburn is 17 years old and has moved 7 times. Along the way, she figured out that music is a huge stress reliever, especially karaoke.
Let's get down to business to defeat the Huns.
Now Ashburn lives outside Fort Lauderdale, and her Army Colonel dad is about to retire. All the moving has been really hard, especially after she settled into a high school in Pennsylvania and suddenly had to move to Florida.
I really had a hard time moving away. I really struggled with depression and like had to end up going to a therapist and was sort of like, what is all this suffering for? Why am I being so sad? Like, what is the purpose of this? I don't want it to be for nothing.
She reached out to another musician friend whose family is deployed to South Korea. The two created Bloom, a military teen support organization. Matthew O is a 17-year-old percussionist and has moved 8 times. The survey that Bloom did in coordination with the National Military Family Association showed 42% of military teens reported low mental well-being and 45% reported moderate mental well-being. That leaves only 13% reporting that they're doing well. O says his family's most recent deployment was especially difficult.
I moved to Korea 2 years ago, and that was kind of a dark time for me. And I was constantly wallowing in self-pity because of what I had left behind.
But, he says, as a musician, he's quick to make friends and get involved. He's doing much better now. He's also the student body president at his high school on a U.S. installation in South Korea and keeps an eye on other students.
If you have students coming in who don't feel welcome, who don't feel like they're being taken care of, you have a very negative environment, and it's very hard to bring people together in that way.
Colorado Springs-based family therapist Lisa Collingridge saw exactly that. She got into the field of mental health 5 years ago after noticing a gap in services for her children, who are military teens themselves. Her family has moved 7 times with her husband's military career.
It's emotional dysregulation that they don't know how to manage, and they don't have anyone that they're connected with to help them navigate those feelings.
She says that instability creates risk factors that can lead to a mental health diagnosis. That's bad for the kids and also the future of the armed forces. 65% of those surveyed said they intend to serve, compared to 14% of their peers in civilian families.
If we eliminate those kids because they've gone through mental health problems that were a result of military lifestyle, what type of messages are we sending?
The Department of Defense does have some mental health programs for military dependents, but Collingridge says they're not enough. As for what the general population can do,
invite them to participate in the community. We love to say military kids are resilient, and they are, but I don't want them to have to be resilient. I want them to be taken care of.
In addition to starting Bloom, Ashburn and O have also written and recorded a song about how it feels to move so often. It's called Uprooted and compares constant deployments to a monster uprooting a tree.
And after the tree had been ripped up and hurled, it found itself standing.
and Ashburn use Bloom to create a sense of community through the web and social media platforms like TikTok and Instagram. Ashburn says they're trying to take the stresses and sad parts of military life and help them bloom into something prettier. In Shawnee, Kansas, I'm Ann Knigendorf.
Do you have a team that you just root against no matter who they're playing? Well, a lot of people do. And that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Rivalries are important for the business of sports. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Joe Cobbs, professor of sports business and event management at Northern Kentucky University, determines why some teams bring out fans' passion, but others do not.
Yankees suck. Yankees suck. If you have ever attended a Red Sox baseball game at Fenway Park, you have probably heard this chant from Boston fans, even when the Red Sox opponent is, say, the Tampa Bay Rays and not the New York Yankees. Why do some opponents, such as the Yankees, produce such a rage in fans, while others, such as the Rays, are practically ignored? Understanding the ingredients to rivalry is important because rivals' animosity often translates to peak attention in the form of high ticket sales and broadcast viewership, adding to the riches of the sports investors. This antisocial yet pro-demand dichotomy of rivalry creates a dilemma. We don't want fighting in the bleachers, but we love the drama. Ongoing research from the No Rivalry Project has begun to illuminate a resolution by dissecting the three categories of ingredients that commonly result in fans' perception of rivalry: the conditions of conflict, strong similarities, and deep differences. When perceptions of intergroup rivalry are driven by the conflict condition of competitive parity or strong similarities in value, rivalry can act in a pro-social nature, resulting in respect for the opponent. However, when perceptions of rivalry are driven by the deep differences of disparate values or discrimination by authorities, rivalry often perpetuates antisocial outcomes, such as prejudice toward rival fans, which is further exacerbated when your perceived rival fails to reciprocate your recognition of the rivalry. So the next time you see a baseball game involving the Red Sox and Tampa Bay Rays, keep in mind that the Yankees are also present, if only in the minds of Boston and Tampa Bay fans.
That was Joe Cobbs of Northern Kentucky University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledges podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.
Thank you.